Well, said Anise sometime on Tuesday afternoon before the big storm hit, I guess this is just an opportunity for us to practice not being in control. You could say that again, I thought, and have been thinking ever since. On Wednesday, as I stood at my window drinking my coffee and watching the wind whip over the barren hillsides outside my house, I felt somehow small, even a little bit vulnerable, caught up in something that was not only not of my own design, but something so big that my own designs couldn't impact it a whit. The world outside our doorways this last week and a half proved without a doubt that we are part of something larger than ourselves. And that something may have planned for our week that are quite different than the ones we have so carefully endeavored to capture in our portable electronic calendar devices. Given that, it's no wonder that I felt small and a little bit vulnerable standing there at my window clutching my coffee cup. I, along with the rest of us, was in the grasp of something way too big. And it was, for me anyway, a teensy bit disconcerting. A kind of dis-ease that I couldn't really put my finger on settled over me during this storm as I watched the snow descend on us all. And I got sort of psychically itchy. Not so much from cabin fever, but I think from control withdrawal. Control, after all, is something that many of us have the luxury of imagining for ourselves. When we are cold, we heat the room with the flick of a switch. When we are hungry, a pizza is a phone call away. When the car doesn't work, we call the mechanic. And when our hearts are broken, we call the therapist. Control is a powerful illusion until all of a sudden it isn't anymore. And that's what it felt like to me in the grip of this storm. Like the whole thing was out of my control entirely. And yet, in a way, it was also lovely. Others of us stood at our windows and watched the winds blow by with gratitude because here finally was a chance to relax into the unknown, to embrace a full day without a single thing scheduled, to hibernate in the luxury of it all, or get charged up on the adventure of not knowing what comes next. Others of us, of course, were just plain cold, because we didn't have heat or power or a way to get up and down our driveways. The unknown for some of us became a source not just of psychic discomfort, but of fear and uncertainty and a kind of chill that runs deeper than any warm mittens could tend to. No matter what feelings the snow brought you and your family underneath it all, Anise was right. It wouldn't be the first time. This last week and a half has been for us all, no matter how the storm impacted us, a chance to practice the fine art of being out of control. Perhaps this is a gift we would not have chosen for ourselves, but it has been, for most of us, a gift nonetheless. And I have a theory about this whole being out of control business. This entire experience of being caught up in something bigger than your plans, my theory is this. Most things in life that actually matter, the kind of experiences that really transform us, require us to let go of our illusions of being in charge anyway. So frankly, most of us really needed the practice. Thanks, Mother Nature, I guess. I got an email this week from someone I don't actually know who had been reading our website. And she saw on the website a descriptive blurb for this very sermon. And the blurb stated in part, "How do you love and how are you striving to love more fully?" This individual emailed me with the simple message, "How do we learn to love? I don't even know what love is." That's all it said. Sent to me via the streams and threads of cyberspace, and I'm quite certain that she expected some sort of answer, or at least a thoughtful response. It is in moments like that when I am reminded just how little I know, and that this pulpit does not, in fact, endow me with a direct connection to the source of all wisdom. Sorry, guys. How do we learn to love? I, to be honest, am not always entirely sure what I'm talking about when I write those sermon blurbs, and I offer no guarantees that I know what I'm talking about now, but I suspect that learning to love isn't really possible. Like a snowstorm, it's not something you can get your arms around, nor something any of us have the power to control. Loving, I think, has something to do with letting go of the whole idea that we can learn any such thing in the first place. How do we learn to love? I tend to think it's more about letting ourselves love. Maybe we need to start by losing our illusions of control and submitting to something larger, grander, scarier, and more out of control than we ever could have imagined. Love, of the romantic variety or any other kind, is not a game that we can manage like a chessboard or a plan that we can make for a free Saturday evening in March. I don't care what relationship gurus and Match.com tell you, there is not a foolproof formula for love. As the gospel writers say, it bloweth where it listeth, and it maketh all things new. And no amount of our wrangling can pin it down, give it a formula, and designate its boundaries. We can't make it happen, tell it when to show up, and tell it what to wear. Instead, it captures us, and we give in to it or we do not. That is our choice. To practice some submission to a force greater than ourselves, or to fight it, and in so doing, tie our hearts all in knots. And I'm not so shallow as to think that making oneself open to love or choosing to love will bring a knight in shining armor or a hot babe with a heart of gold riding into your life on a white stallion ready to carry you away. Love doesn't usually work like that. And love doesn't always or often come in the form we have planned for it. It surprises us in unusual places, crops up in where we would not have known to look, and makes itself known in all the nooks and crannies of our lives where we gave up finding it a long, long time ago. In a pastoral conversation, I once heard a congregant describe the way that love saved her life, even when she didn't expect it. She was describing the difference between herself and an abuser who had harmed her in 1,000 different ways. These two people, herself and the person who had hurt her, they came from the same place, the same background, the same amount of opportunity, give or take. But she had chosen to break out and find a fulfilling life, and he had sunk into a sort of crippling despair and the kind of moral turpitude that lets you stomp around on other people's souls. She said of the two of them that the difference underneath it all was that she had maintained her ability to see and appreciate beauty, and he had lost it somewhere along the way. She could love. She saw it. She gave herself over to it, even in the presence of her pain. He couldn't. Instead, he railed against all that was unlovable, and his refusal to see stole his life away, even as her willingness to love gave hers back. She could see beauty, and it transported her. She could surrender herself to the presence of something worth loving, even if nothing at all in her life had gone according to plan. That's the stuff. Not whether or not you have a date, but whether or not you feel compelled, drawn, demanded to love something, anything, so much that you don't care if you can control it or not, compelled to see beauty in whatever form it takes. The best love poem I've come across lately is not a sonnet to some bonny lass, but a poem, in fact, in praise of the sun, of all things. It's by Mary Oliver, and she writes, "Have you ever seen anything in your life more wonderful than the way the sun every evening, relaxed and easy, floats toward the horizon and into the clouds or the hills or the rumpled sea and is gone? And how it slides out again from the blackness every morning on the other side of the world like a red flower streaming upward its heavenly oils, say, on a morning in early summer, at its perfect imperial distance? And have you ever felt for anything such wild love? Do you think that there is anywhere, in any language, a word billowing enough for the pleasure that fills you as the sun reaches out, as it warms you as you stand there empty-handed? Or have you turned from this world? Or have you gone too crazy for power or for things?" Crazy for power, as if we could ever have power over the things that really matter. Crazy for things, as if this one piece of the world we can control, can own, could ever make us happy. As if the sun could ever rise and set for me. As if its inevitable path could ever be altered by my machinations. The sun is a beauty I can only admire, not change. A love I can only participate in, not master. And perhaps it is one thing to talk about the sun in such abstract terms. There it is, you know, all distant and beautiful, and it's not my job to change it, but to love it as it is, up there in the distance, being gorgeous. I can admit that the sun is a beautiful lover that I am not about to change. For she will rise and set of her own accord, no matter what I have to say about it. But could we love one another that way? Empty-handed, vulnerable, without attachment to our own plans for one another and accepting of the fact that we are way beyond each other's control. Could we love one another like a snowstorm that kicks up out of nowhere and changes all our plans? Alters our priorities and forces us to slow down and bear witness to the beauty that was there all along. Could we love one another that way and stop imagining that we're in charge of everything? Could we love one another that way? I'm not sure we always have a choice. As a mother, I love my child with a vulnerability that I cannot even begin to express. I didn't learn to love her. I didn't choose to love her. I don't love her because it fits my image of what love ought to be. I love her because, frankly, I have no choice. Because I am hers and it could be no other way. My hands are empty before that love. Like the sun, she captured me, and like a snowstorm, she changes all my plans. And when I think of love, it's not romance or chocolates that first come to mind, though those things are nice. But rather, strangely enough, my baby's breath when she is crying, which smells of heat and milk and earth, and absolutely everything that's important in this world. Am I a crazy person for holding my crying baby up to my nose to smell her breath? Yeah, maybe. But that's what it does to you, love, I mean. That's what love does to you, whether for the sun, for your neighbor, for your baby, for your friend. It makes you a little crazy. It makes you feel a little out of control and maybe even more than a bit afraid because you are not in charge of it. After all, my baby is not mine. I don't own her. I just get to love her. And though a parent tries to tell their child what they're supposed to do, you can never really tell your child who to be, any more than you can tell your partner, your spouse, or your friend. You're at the mercy of time and destiny and the blowing wind outside the door. You can't plan the lives of the ones you love any more than you could halt the snowflakes or count their number. It is a scary, scary thing, this love, which captures you and will not let you go. That's why in our reading today, Stephen Levine says that if prayer would do it, he'd pray up a storm. If fighting would do it, he'd be a black belt. If contemplation would do it, he would learn every single thing he could. If anything in the world would give meaning and purpose and wonder to life, except the scariest thing of all, he would have gone there. But he saved the hardest for last. The only thing that could ever work. Love, no matter how scary it is. No matter how powerless we are before it. Love. It is in the very nature of the human condition to yearn for it. And when we are disconnected from it, we know. Because there is a dry place where all the beauty should be. There is a portable calendar device where life should be. There is a nicely organized and productive workday where a blizzard should be. There is you and your plan, where there ought to be a connection to that which is larger, the source of all love from whence we come. In the choir anthem that we'll hear shortly, they'll sing actually of a reed flute, just like a flute made of a piece of grass that has been cut, severed from the grassland from which it grew. It yearns to return, to be at the mercy of the winds again, blown hither and yon alongside its brothers and sisters, connected to its source. It's disconnected, it's cut off, and all it wants to be is a part of the whole once again. I am reminded that love is that force which is larger than ourselves, that connects us to all we cannot begin to control and yearn only to be a part of. Great German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer said that love is the reconciliation of man with God. The disunion of men with God, with other men, with the world, and with themselves is at an end when we love, he says. And when we love fully, our origin is given back to us. Love is when we return, at last, to a deep sense of our own connectedness, to the fact that we are part of something larger, to the fact that we're not in charge. We cannot control the storm, but we are a part of it. Just as every single snowflake blows, so are we blown hither and yon into one another's paths, not to fix each other or to fit each other into our plans, but to witness beauty. Love is when our illusion of control fades away, and the reality of our interdependence makes itself known. Love is when we are brave enough to be more than just ourselves, planned and practiced and under control, but part and parcel of this thing which has caught us up and which will not let us go.